The man's only mistake was not to stand up for the national anthem. But that was enough to enrage a patriotic sailor at a victory pageant in Washington in May 1919. When the band had finished playing, the sailor fired three revolver shots into the back of the unpatriotic spectator. As the man crumpled, the rest of the audience clapped and cheered. A small incident, but symptomatic of the mood of ultra-patriotism in America during and after the First World War. The targets varied. First Germans, then political radicals, finally all who weren't of Aryan descent. But as we'll see, these campaigns to ensure 100% Americanism had lasting effects, closing the open door to immigrants from Europe, and even for a decade, shutting down America's saloons and breweries. Americans of German descent were the first group to experience the heat of this new nationalism, even before the United States entered the war in 1917. Once Germany and America were at war, anti-German feeling became almost a crusade. In scores of cities, German language was removed from the school curriculum. German music was ostracized, Wagner, Brahms, even Beethoven. Hamburgers were renamed Liberty Steaks and sauerkraut Liberty Cabbage. Encouraged by President Woodrow Wilson, Congress passed tough wartime espionage and sedition acts, the latter targeting anyone who spoke or wrote any disloyal, profane, scurrilous or abusive language against the government, flag or uniform of the United States. Nothing of the sort had been seen since the Alien and Sedition Acts of the 1790s, at the height of the panic about the French Revolution. One of those who fell foul of the new legislation was Eugene Debs, the veteran socialist leader, when he linked the landed ruling class in Germany, the Junkers, with the elite in the United States.
"I hate, I loathe, I despise Junkers and Junkerdom. I have no earthly use for the Junkers of Germany, and not one particle more use for the Junkers in the United States. They tell us that we live in a great free republic, that our institutions are democratic, that we are a free and self-governing people. This is too much, even for a joke."
For those remarks, Debs spent 2.5 years in prison. In 1920, he campaigned as Socialist Party candidate for the presidency while in the Atlanta penitentiary. The pre-war agitation against Germans with divided loyalties now became a crusade for 100% Americanism. These were the years when Bolshevism seemed about to flood from Russia across Germany and Central Europe. Many Americans feared it would engulf them as well. The communist movement in the US was minuscule, some 70,000 people in 1919, less than 0.1% of the population. But there was a rash of strikes after victory was won, reflecting the pent-up reaction against wartime wage restraint. Textiles and steel, basic industries reliant on immigrant labour, were at the heart of the strikes in 1919, and American vigilante groups sprang up in retaliation. A member of the so-called Loyal Legion in the steel town of Gary, Indiana, recalled how they kept law and order with blackjacks, lumps of lead wrapped up in leather and swung like clubs.
"Our method of work was to grab a man's right arm with the operator's left hand, then bring down the blackjack across the hand bone or wrist of the man thus caught. One rap was enough, and we could go on to the next man. We have a nice hospital in Gary. There were some 35 people in there the next day with broken wrists and hands."
There was also a small anarchist movement in America, which made no secret of its aims. One circular that appeared in New England declared,
"Do not think that only foreigners are anarchists. We are a great number right here at home. The storm is within, and very soon we'll leap and crash and annihilate you in blood and fire. You have shown no pity to us. We will do likewise. We will dynamite you."
And they nearly did in 1919. Just before May Day, the international holiday for workers, postal office staff in New York found a set of homemade parcel bombs addressed to conservative congressmen and officials, as well as business tycoons like John D. Rockefeller. Most of the packages had been put on one side because of insufficient postage, but a couple did get through, and one, addressed to a former US senator, blew off the hands of the maid who opened it. The press was full of headlines like, "Reds planned Mayday murders." Having botched the mail bombs, the plotters decided to do special delivery. Around midnight on June the 2nd, 1919, there were explosions at the homes of prominent figures in seven cities from Boston to Pittsburgh. The most sensational was at the Washington residence of U.S. Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer. The whole front of his house was blown in, and windows were shattered all along the street. Palmer himself was showered with glass. So the threat was real, but it was tiny. Maybe a few dozen serious terrorists. Yet neither the country nor the government knew that, and in the fevered atmosphere, they acted on their fears. Attorney General Palmer, smarting from his brush with death, undertook a big shake-up of the Justice Department, creating a new Bureau of Investigation, forebear of the FBI, and a General Intelligence Division to track down terrorist radicals. Its first boss was a young, ambitious clerk called J. Edgar Hoover. In 1924, he took over the Bureau of Investigation and ran it for nearly half a century. In November 1919, Palmer's revamped Justice Department mounted raids all across the country, rounding up several thousand foreign-born radicals. Men were often beaten without provocation and then held for weeks or months in crowded, unsanitary jails. About 800 were eventually deported. There was widespread support for these Palmer raids and for the deportations, with one patriotic speaker in California declaring,
"These murderous wild beasts of our otherwise blessed republic should be given a bottle of water and a pint of meal and shoved out into the ocean on a raft when the wind is blowing seaward."
But others protested at the ruthless violation of civil liberties. A group of distinguished lawyers condemned
the utterly illegal acts which have been committed by those charged with the highest duty of enforcing the laws. Acts which have caused widespread suffering and unrest, have struck at the foundation of American free institutions, and have brought the name of our country into disrepute.
Eventually, Palmer overreached himself. With one eye on the Democratic presidential nomination in 1920, he whipped up a public panic in advance of May Day. Papers carried lurid headlines such as,
"Terror reign by radicals," says Palmer.
"Nationwide uprising on Saturday."
But nothing happened, and Palmer was transformed almost overnight from one of the most respected men in America into a figure of fun. With strikes abating, the country pulling out of its post-war slump, and the Bolshevik tide receding in Europe, the Red Scare was over. But the tide of 100% Americanism surged on into new channels, or rather back into older ones, such as anti-immigrant feeling. The foreign-born were now about one-seventh of the total US population. The movement to restrict immigration gained new life at the end of the war, when the Atlantic was reopened to migrants at a time when the US was suffering from its sharp post-war recession. Union leaders joined in, concerned at the threat posed by cheap foreign labour to American workers' jobs. In 1921 and 1924, Congress passed acts that finally closed the open door. These didn't stop immigration from Latin America because of the need for Mexican farm labour, but they did slash overall immigration from Europe to a mere 150,000 a year. Within that, Congress imposed national quotas, discriminating against those from Italy, Russia, and the Balkans, essentially because they were not of Nordic background. Immigration from China and Japan had already been totally banned. So the intent of these new immigration laws was clearly racist, as a few congressmen openly admitted, among them Senator Ellison Smith of South Carolina.
I think we now have sufficient population in our country for us to shut the door and to breed up a pure, unadulterated American citizenship. Thank God we have in America perhaps the largest percentage of any country in the world of the pure, unadulterated Anglo-Saxon stock. I would make this not an asylum for the oppressed of all countries, but a country to assimilate and perfect that splendid type of manhood that has made America the foremost nation in her progress and in her power.
The crusade for social conformity had one other triumph. For decades, evangelical Protestants, mostly from British and Scandinavian stock, had campaigned against the demon of drink. In the 1900s, their efforts were given new impetus by the Anti-Saloon League, a dynamic pressure group funded mostly by subscribers in local churches. Preacher Billy Sunday, who'd given up professional baseball to become a mass evangelist, spoke for many of them.
The saloon is an infidel. It has no faith in God, has no religion. It respects the thief, and it esteems the blasphemer. It fills the prisons and the penitentiaries. It cocks the highwayman's pistol. It puts the rope in the hands of the mob. It is the anarchist of the world.
This crusade to close the saloons and ban the sale of liquor had an ethnic dimension, since the main opponents were Catholics of German and Irish descent. The anti-German mood of the war strengthened the prohibitionist case by silencing the powerful German brewing industry, companies like Pabst and Schlitz, and by adding the persuasive argument of wartime efficiency. Closing down the breweries, it was claimed, would keep soldiers sober and ensure that grain was used for food. And so in December 1917, Congress approved an amendment to the Constitution banning the manufacture, import and sale of intoxicating liquors. After being ratified by the states, in some cases very reluctantly, it came into force in January 1920. The Anti-Saloon League was exultant.
At 1 minute past 12 tomorrow morning, a new nation will be born. Tonight, John Barleycorn makes his last will and testament. Now for an era of clear thinking and clean living. The Anti-Saloon League wishes every man, woman, and child a happy, dry year.
Some of these Americanization laws passed in the fevered war years proved enduring. Immigration quotas survived until the 1950s. But the dry utopia of clear thinking and clean living was a fantasy. Almost immediately, the backlash against prohibition began. Centerpiece of a decade that celebrated life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as never before.